Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, July the 10th. Senate Democrats are set to again challenge the administration's handling of the war in Iraq. It will come as the Senate begins debating a bill authorizing military spending. One Democratic amendment is expected to call for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq in 120 days. Most troops would have to be out of Iraq by next spring. Democrats are being energized by the defections of at least three more Senate Republicans. Oops, make that four, who have come out in the recent past, advocating a change in U.S. policy in Iraq. Senator Olympia Snow of Maine announced yesterday that she would support the efforts to force a withdrawal. Until yesterday, Snow was saying that she would wait until the September report on progress in Iraq. In parting company with President Bush, she joined Republican Senators Pete Domenici of New Mexico, Richard Lugar of Indiana, and George Voinovich of Ohio, all who seek a shift in Bush's Iraq plan. We are going to talk about these Republican defections and how that's going to affect the debate on the war in Iraq. We'll talk about the latest efforts to end U.S. involvement in Iraq and the political debate that we can expect over the next couple of weeks. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Will the eroding Republican support for the war end up being the tipping point this time? Will the democratically controlled Congress manage to pass any amendments calling for U.S. troop withdrawal? Meanwhile, yesterday, Iraq's foreign minister warned that any quick withdrawal of U.S. forces would lead the country into a full-fledged civil war. How will that warning play into the debate? We wonder what you want to see happen and what questions you have of our guest political analyst. He is David Cannon, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Good to be with you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being with us. What do you make of these Republicans defecting from the Bush administration on the war policy?
Well, I think it's a very significant development, and it's clear that the Republicans now in the Senate especially, but to some extent in the House as well, are starting to reflect public opinion on the war. If you see the most recent polls, they're almost 70%, in some polls up to 75, 76% of the American public now want a change in our policy to either decrease the number of troops or remove all of them from Iraq in a fairly short timetable, certainly by next year. And so I think Republicans, especially over the July 4th break, being home, hearing from their constituents, heard more and more of them saying, look, it's time to get out. We really are tired of this war. And so the four recent defections in the Senate are in addition then to John Warner and Chuck Hagel, who have been longtime opponents, Republican opponents of the war. So now it's a pretty significant number. A few more defections gives the majority the 60 votes they need to stop any kind of filibusters on the war. You're still a little bit short of the two-thirds that would be necessary to override a presidential veto. But it's getting closer, and I think the White House is definitely starting to feel the heat.
Yeah. Who's next?
Well, in terms of other Republicans who are on the fence, Norm Coleman has to be someone else who is really likely to announce fairly soon, I would think. He's up for re-election in 08. He comes from a very liberal state, Minnesota, that has very strong majorities of people in Minnesota who are opposed to the war. He's facing a strong challenge from a variety of Democrats who can run against him, and largely on the issue of the war. So I'd be surprised if Norm Coleman didn't come out fairly soon. Others also might include Susan Collins from Maine. Yesterday when I was talking to your assistant, and she asked me who were the likely defectors, I mentioned Olympia Snow as one like 2 hours later, she came through on that one. And Susan Collins, her colleague from Maine, I think would be another one who'd announce fairly soon. And there are a handful of others on the fence. One Democrat, Dan Bourne from Oklahoma, has been a supporter of the war, and he's likely to flip fairly soon.
Yeah. Are all these flippers in politically vulnerable seats?
Well, certainly Snow and Collins and Coleman would fit that bill. Boren less so. I mean, he comes from a fairly Republican state, but even Republicans are starting to turn against the war. I mean, they haven't hit a majority yet of Republicans, but strong majorities of independents, over 3/4 of independents, and of course, about 85-90% of Democrats. But it's getting close to a plurality of Republicans even who are showing skepticism about the war. And so even in a fairly strong Republican state like Oklahoma, supporting the war is becoming less and less of a viable political position.
Yeah, we heard Chuck Hagel on one of the Sunday shows, I think it was Meet the Press. The political support for this war is gone. It's eroding. It's eroding the Republican Party.
Yeah, I think Hagel is exactly right. And there's no doubt that the White House is starting to reflect this now in their internal debates. There was a long story on New York Times yesterday about the internal debates that have been going on in the White House now for the last couple of weeks. And it seems pretty clear that some of the voices for a change in policy are starting to gain the upper hand. In fact, one senior White House official who was quoted anonymously in the article said that he thinks that the September 15th date is going to be the end of the debate rather than the beginning of the debate in terms of a change in policy.
Yeah. Well, why not, like Olympia Snow yesterday, while she said she would wait until this September report. It's not that long from now, September. Why say I'm going to support withdrawal right now rather than wait for that September report?
Well, I think it's becoming increasingly clear to those fence sitters that the benchmarks are not even close to being met. You know, they had the 18 benchmarks that were set in the legislation that was passed a few months ago, and these included a lot of political goals, like having the revenue sharing on oil revenue, having the complete revision of the Constitution, holding new regional elections, the depacification of the military, and so on, agreement on regional boundaries. None of these political goals are even close to being met. In fact, I think we're farther away from them now than we were before, with several prominent Sunnis pulling out of the government. And so it seems like the political turmoil inside Iraq is becoming more and more evident to those fence sitters. And they're saying, boy, I don't see any kind of realistic possibility of even coming close to those benchmarks by September 15th.
Yeah, that there's this draft report that's already in the news right now. It says that the Iraqi government has not met any of its targets for political, economic, or other reforms. So it's not looking good.
That's right. And you combine that then with the at least mixed at best results from the surge on the military front, where there definitely has been some progress in a few neighborhoods of Baghdad, also in the Anbar province. They've had some success in working with local Sunni leaders to fight against al-Qaeda. So there's been some military success in the last few months, but also it's clear that the surge is not having anywhere near the impact that we were hoping it would have. You still have a lot of sectarian violence. The number of suicide bombings actually has gone up. The number of civilian casualties and military casualties has gone up, as you would expect in a period of increased military action, but still we have not had as much success on the military side as we would have hoped, and complete failure on the political side.
What about Tony Snow, though, yesterday saying, hey, this surge has just started. The troop level got to where it needed to be like barely a couple of weeks ago. How can we expect these benchmarks to be met when the surge really just started?
Well, that's right. That's the White House line right now, is that we have to give this more time, need to be patient and see how this is going to play out. And on the military side, I think there's some truth in that clearly the full effect of the surge has only been on the ground for a few weeks. But I think it's on the political side where people are increasingly pessimistic as well, and probably even more important, that they just don't see the Iraqi government being able to take control of itself. And because one of the critical benchmarks that needed to be met was that the Iraqi military would be able to take over security of all of the Iraqi provinces by the end of the year, and that's a pipe dream at this point.
Yeah, what effect will the New York Times on Sunday, this full page or the entire editorial page, calling for U.S. troops to leave Iraq as soon as possible?
Right. I think that's a fairly significant development as well, showing that the opinion leaders of the country are increasingly turning against the war as well. The New York Times had kind of withheld judgment for a long time, trying to take a middle road kind of position, saying that the cost of withdrawal would be higher than staying, that we can't risk the civil war. But one of the main conclusions they reach in that editorial is that the people who say that if we withdraw, there's going to be a civil war, ignore the fact that there's a civil war right now. We already are in the middle of a civil war in Iraq, and it's, I think the American troops are maybe dampening down the level of severity of that war, but clearly there already is a civil war there.
Yeah.
And so the New York Times and other opinion leaders now have finally reached the conclusion that the costs of staying are in fact higher than withdrawal, and that what we need is a steady and reasonable pace to the withdrawal, and also maintaining some regional bases, perhaps in Kuwait, Turkey, if they'll let us, to have some ability to come back in if, say, Al-Qaeda were to set up some significant bases in Iraq. We would need the capability to have some military presence in that part of the world.
So when Iraq's foreign minister warns that a quick withdrawal would lead the country into a full-fledged civil war, that warning's not going to play much into the debate?
Well, it certainly will play into the debate, and I think what the supporters of President Bush's policy would point to especially would be the danger of, say, Iran and Syria, Turkey, getting drawn into an Iraqi civil war. And if that were to happen and it becomes no longer a civil war in Iraq, but a regional conflict between many nations, that's the kind of thing that I think is the worst-case scenario. And they're playing on fears of that happening is probably the strongest argument that supporters of President Bush's position have at this point.
We are talking with David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison, talking about Republican support for the war in Iraq eroding, more prominent Republicans calling on the Bush administration for a change in strategy, including pushing for a quicker withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. 1-800-642-1234. We welcome your thoughts and questions about this in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you with us on this Tuesday, July the 10th. It's 22 minutes past 8 o'clock. Coming up this afternoon, At Issue with Ben Marins. According to Ben's guest, after 5, immediate withdrawal from Iraq would harm U.S. interests and embolden the terrorists. He'll be talking with the author of The Final Move Beyond Iraq. That's coming up after 5 o'clock. We're talking about politics and Iraq, Congress, the president, and war policy. Democrats in Congress are set again to challenge the administration's handling of the war this week. The Senate will begin debating a bill authorizing military spending, and a number of amendments are expected that would call for troop withdrawal and other means to hasten an end to U.S. involvement in Iraq. And Professor Cannon, what are you predicting is going to happen with this military spending bill?
Well, I think there certainly will be serious efforts to pass a troop withdrawal amendment at this point. I think also the amendment that Robert Byrd and Hillary Clinton are working on to basically revoke the authorization, the congressional authorization of use of force that President Bush is relying on right now, is another thing that probably will get majority support. So my guess is that a lot of these anti-war amendments are going to pass this time around. But it at this point does not look like they would have the two-thirds vote necessary to override a presidential veto. And so, as happened in the last round, Democrats were able to muster majorities in both the House and the Senate, but they didn't come close to the two-thirds to override. I think they'll be closer this time, but unless we get a handful of additional defections over the next couple of weeks, it looks like they'll be short of that two-thirds. But I think that the momentum is going to keep building in the favor of the anti-war advocates in the House and the Senate. And I think by probably this fall, I would guess that there would be that necessary two-thirds to override a presidential veto.
Well, let's go to the phone. Steele in Appleton joins us first. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, Ed, I have a question. Is how tied in when we say we have 126,000 troops in Iraq? Actually, it's double that with the contracts, civilian mercenaries, and support services. And so when we talk about withdrawal, how are those going to be included, or is that some little special thing that could stay forever?
Well, no, my sense is that the contractors, from what I've read, would also be, for the most part, withdrawn because they are employed by the U.S. government. So if the U.S. government troops, they're mostly support services for the troops. So if the troops are gone, a lot of those support services are no longer needed. So it could be that a small number of private contractors could possibly stay on being employed by the Iraqi military. That's a possibility, but the numbers would be relatively small.
Yeah. Thanks, Steele. John and Slinger, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to hear a little different angle on things. I'm very concerned about civil war in the Middle East. I lived in Iran before the revolution. I understand a bit about how these people think and function. Has anybody in Congress seriously projected what a civil war in Iraq would mean for the world? And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, as we talked about a little bit in just the introductory conversation, I think that the potential for civil war is the greatest threat of troop withdrawal, certainly, and it's something that people in Congress are taking very seriously. And the two sides of the debate are basically the people who fear the descent into a major civil war involving the regional conflict that I talked about before. They argue that we have to keep troops on the ground to prevent that from happening. The folks on the other side who argue for an immediate withdrawal, or at least over a period of 6 to 12 months, say that right now our presence of American troops on the ground in Iraq is actually preventing a political solution to the conflict. As long as we're there, it actually continues to increase the likelihood of conflict, and that we, by withdrawing, we force the Iraqi government to take responsibility for its own security. And so that would argue for withdrawing the troops primarily to the United States, but also then keeping some regional bases, as I mentioned, in, say, maybe Kuwait and Turkey, to where they could redeploy some troops if they were needed in an emergency kind of situation. So that, again, there's no way to say with any certainty how this is going to play out. And the caller is exactly right that the greatest fear is of a regional conflict type of civil war that really would be a source of great instability for the region and would certainly would pose long-term problems for, say, even the security of Israel and other American interests in the area, and also say nothing about the fate of the people who live in that part of the world. But the question is, can we prevent that by staying? And more people are concluding that no, we can't, that we're in fact making the problem worse rather than better.
Sinead and Eau Claire, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, my question really goes right along those same exact lines, actually. The only part that remains unanswered to me is just a little bit more specific. Instead of a kind of a national conflict, because I think that's more of what we're talking about right in Iraq, if we leave that there's a civil war. If it's regional with, like, Syria and Iran and Saudi Arabia with the the Shiites and Sunnis and everything that surrounds. And then I was even going to ask about Israel's involvement in that, if it became more of a regional conflict than a national conflict. I guess I was going to ask what you thought about, like, World War III, and if Israel's involved in that, then wouldn't the United States have a bigger war on their hands than they have right now?
Wow.
Yeah, wow. That's right. I mean, World War III is clearly the absolute worst-case scenario. I mean, it's not entirely unreasonable to see it going down a path that could lead to something like that. But my sense is that wouldn't happen, that the rest of the international community has enough of an interest for stability in the Middle East that we wouldn't be going alone anymore if it looked like we were heading in that direction. I think you would have European forces getting involved, the United Nations would get involved. I think there'd be a huge interest in preventing that kind of regional conflict spreading into an international conflict from developing. So I think there would be very strong forces to try to prevent that from happening. But again, it's not inconceivable that could happen. And the caller, I think, is right to point to the other interest that are be pulling Iraq apart. And so it's quite possible to see a civil war developing that actually would partition Iraq into several different segments. You'd have the Kurdish kind of independent region in the north. You'd have the more Sunni central area and the more Shiite area in the rest of the country. And that is possible that after a bloody civil war, you could have Iraq divided into three smaller entities. And that's a possible outcome that no one wants it at this point, but could actually be a more long-term stable solution to the problems faced by that part of the country.
Yeah, Professor Cannon, it says here Tony Snow says though that President Bush is not contemplating a military withdrawal from Iraq despite the erosion of Republican support for his war policy. And Tony Snow answered other questions from reporters yesterday. Could that really be that Bush is not wavering whatsoever on this question of troop withdrawal?
Well, it's possible that he's not, but it's clear that at least his advisors are. And this, the story again in the New York Times yesterday about these very high-level discussions about what to do in Iraq. I mean, Gates canceled a trip to Latin America to have an emergency meeting on this issue last week. And so if all of the high-level people were there, and clearly they were talking about what they were calling post-surge redeployment. Now, they might not want to call that withdrawal, but post-surge redeployment, at least at a minimum, means taking troops out of the combat active areas of where most insurgents are to more of a green zone strategy where the troops would be kind of there but not really actively involved in military conflict. And so at least at a minimum they're talking about that. And it seems like, at least according to these inside sources from what was going on in those discussions, the advisors are definitely talking about withdrawal. Now maybe Bush hasn't changed his mind and maybe it's going to be tough to convince him to go along with what his advisors are saying now. But at least those discussions are happening in the White House.
Yeah, it says also that Defense Secretary Robert Gates had a planned trip to Latin America, and that was canceled, and he's going to, I guess, concentrate on Iraq now.
Right, exactly. That's what I mentioned with coming back to this emergency meeting, absolutely.
Yeah. Next is John in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, well, everybody wants to predict what a horrible thing's going to happen if we leave. I think it's necessary to examine what's happened since we've been there for the last 4.5 years. The John Hopkins study has been upgraded now. It's 800,000 at least civilians that have excess civilian deaths since we entered that country, and at least a quarter of those have been due to U.S. bombing, which we haven't been informed about at all. Okay, so 800,000 dead, they estimate at least three times that wounded. So that's 2.4 plus 800,000, that's 3.2 million. 2.2 million Iraqis have left their country. 1.8 million Iraqis are internally displaced. They've been ethnically cleansed from Shiite and Sunni areas all over that country. You add all these figures together and you get 1 in 4 Iraqis have either been wounded, killed, or displaced due to this war. This mayhem, it's obscene. The guilt I feel for being a part of this country that propagated this on these innocent people is beyond belief. And the only way, if the American people want to get realistic about this, are you willing to put up with this kind of mayhem, or you really want to get serious like in Vietnam and start really carpet bombing these people out of existence? Because there's no way they're going to stop. There's no way they're going to turn their oil over to us. And as far as the Republicans and Democrats, what I see in the Republicans is they're still not willing to get out of this. They want to follow the study group thing. They're not for completely getting out. They're just turning tail because elections are coming up. Somebody better get serious about this. This is a world-class calamity that we're visiting on these people.
Wow.
Well, yeah, so there's kind of the strongest statement of the view on the other side. And clearly, the statistics on the number of civilian casualties have been contested, and the Johns Hopkins study, while certainly a credible estimate, has been countered by other experts who say the figure is much lower than that. But even if it's much lower, obviously the caller is right that the human toll in Iraq has been incredibly high, and whether it's 1 million or 4 million that have been affected, it's still a huge number of people who have been affected either directly by being wounded or killed or being forced to leave their homes, and there's no doubt about that. But the problem, though, is, and this is what all of the people in the Senate and the President and the White House are struggling with right now is, at this point, there are no good answers. And that's the problem, is that, yes, this is a horrible situation, and yet I completely agree with the caller that, you know, that we have done some terrible things to that part of the world. But the question is, how do you move forward from where we are now and not make it worse? And that's what our leaders are struggling with at this point, because there is a potential danger that immediate withdrawal would lead to worse things happening. I personally believe that it's the right thing to do to bring the troops home, but I'm very aware of the potential cost of doing that.
Yeah, and not to downplay the Iraqi civilian deaths, but I would venture to say that the support for this war is also so low, or maybe more so low, because of the 3,600-plus U.S. troops and tens of thousands of U.S. troops wounded in this war for a reason that the American public doesn't really understand or believe.
Right. Now, clearly, certainly the focus here in this country is always more on the U.S. Mm-hmm. military casualties, but the Iraqi civilian casualties mm-hmm. are many, many times higher than what the mm-hmm. losses we've suffered.
Dave in Menominee, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I think the media has to question President Bush. It baffles me that nobody questions him when he says, if we don't fight them there, they're going to follow us back here. And nobody says, well, you should be asking, well, how are they going to follow us here? And by boat or by plane? And aren't we doing something to keep them from doing that now? And what would we be doing differently if we pulled out?
Yeah, well, Dave raises a very important point here that we actually haven't touched on yet, and that is the link between the war in Iraq and the war on terror, because this is something that President Bush from the beginning has been trying to play up, that the reason we're fighting the war in Iraq is because of the war on terror, and we have to fight them there so we don't fight them here, as Dave said. But I totally agree with him that there has not been enough of a discussion about the link between those two, and in fact, there's a trade-off between those two. Rather than seeing them as complementary, you can make a strong argument there's a trade-off between the two, that by dedicating more resources to fighting the war in Iraq, we actually are exacerbating the problem of the war on terror. We're making terrorism more likely by creating a whole new generation of terrorists in that part of the world, giving them more basis for maneuvering and training their terrorists. And if we would take even a fraction of that money being spent in the war in Iraq and instead spend it on things like security for our ports, where there's still a fairly high level of vulnerability, and other areas where we could strengthen the war on terror against actual terrorists coming into this country, I think we'd be much safer than we are by fighting the war in Iraq. And so I think Dave's exactly right that we need to examine that trade-off much more carefully and much more closely.
Thanks, Dave. Scott in La Crosse is with us. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning to you both. Thank you for the program. My question has to do with a proposal by Ambassador Peter Galbraith that would basically say, get the U.S. troops up into Kurdistan, and that would be the footprint, and that this would have the advantage of giving the U.S. a presence in the region. From what I understand, the Kurds actually like the U.S. and would welcome the U.S. being there. And it also seems that has an additional benefit of easing the minds of the Turks about a possible Kurdish regional nation, because the U.S. presence there would, I would think, tend to deflect that. Now, I know Galbraith made this proposal a couple of years ago, and the way things change over there, my question for you is that a viable option? And I mean, is it still a viable option? Are those dynamics still in place that would make that something where they would actually welcome us and want us there? And effectively, if that were the partition and that was a part of the country that the U.S. chose to be in, where, as I understand, they also have oil, is that something you think this administration is likely to embrace as a fallback position?
Well, that's a great question, and I would. My sense is that, yes, that is still a viable option, and certainly any long-term solution here is going to involve some continued military presence of the United States in that part of the world, whether it's small force in Kuwait or Turkey or in the Kurdish area of Iraq. I think those are really the three options at this point. And the Kurdish option isn't talked about as much right now as Kuwait and Turkey, just because of the internal political dynamics in Iraq and how the Sunnis and Shiites wouldn't be as happy about that deployment of forces and of American forces in the Kurdish areas. I think that could hasten a partitioning of Iraq if the United States were to do that, and there would be fairly serious political fallout from that. But yes, I think it is one of the things that still is on the table, still is being talked about, and I'm not sure. We're not privy to the inside discussions and all their details, but I would be surprised if that was at the top of the White House list. But it's probably somewhere down the list in terms of an option they might consider.
We are talking about Iraq and politics with David Cannon, political science professor at UW-Madison. Senate Democrats set to begin debate this week on a military spending bill. One Democratic amendment is expected to call for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq in 120 days. Democrats are energized in part by the defections of more prominent Republicans who are advocating a change in U.S. policy in Iraq. Also out this week, a draft report on progress in Iraq that shows little progress is being made. Also, a full-page editorial in the New York Times on Sunday calling for U.S. troops to leave Iraq. We are talking about the latest efforts to end U.S. involvement in Iraq and the political debate that is expected over the next couple of weeks or maybe months. And we welcome your thoughts and questions for our guest at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hope you stay tuned. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn coming up after 9 o'clock. Can media fairness be mandated? That's the question for John and his guest after 9 o'clock when they discuss the Fairness Doctrine and calls to bring back the Fairness Doctrine. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. Tomorrow, by the way, during this hour, we'll talk with another UW-Madison professor, Jeremy Suri, who has written a book on Henry Kissinger. That's coming up tomorrow between 8 and 9. Talking with UW-Madison political science professor David Cannon during this hour about Iraq and efforts in Congress that are starting again this week to withdraw troops from Iraq. Cliff in Appleton is our next caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I believe that if we do pull out, things will definitely get worse. But before the war, I wrote three senators and told them if we invaded, it would be like Pandora's box. I feel we have no business there. And even though if we pull out, things will get worse, it's an immoral war. And American interests are also for fairness. And we can't, justify our continued presence there because things will get worse because we have no business there. Mm-hmm. And I'm just interested in your reaction.
All right, Professor Cannon.
Well, I think that's a very sort of well-formed and reasonable position that, even if there are costs to withdrawing, we have no business being there in the first place, and that should be the bottom line consideration as to whether or not we withdraw. And I think for a lot of opponents of the war, that is exactly the rationale that they would use and the thought process they would use to reach the conclusion we have to pull out. So, no, I think that I think he speaks, I think Cliff speaks for millions of Americans when he articulates that view.
Mm-hmm. Roy in Hurley is with us now. Hi, Roy.
Good morning.
Morning.
My favorite President Eisenhower once said, the military industrial complex takes over this country. We are lost. And we're just about as lost as you can get. I voted Republican once since that time, and I got Nixon. And now this crew that's in there now is the most secretive that we've ever had in the White House. So I think there's a lot of changes that need to be made, and one of them is to get this bunch out of there. Thank you.
All right, well, so it's a little... why don't I ask you, Professor Cannon, what you think about... activist Cindy Sheehan saying that she's going to run against Nancy Pelosi for her congressional seat if Nancy Pelosi doesn't put impeachment back on the table.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And, in fact, that's one thing we haven't really talked about yet, is sort of the electoral implications of positions on the war in Iraq. And so Pelosi is one potential target here. And it's possible that an independent campaign from Cindy Sheehan could, you know, really draw enough voters away from Pelosi to, you know, to make her electorally vulnerable. I, you know, have to see how that plays out. But I think that's a challenge that Pelosi would take seriously. I doubt it's going to shift her position on impeachment. I don't think she's going to immediately, you know, call for investigations and hearings on impeachment. But it is something that Pelosi, I think, will be concerned about, is having that kind of challenge in her general election. But the other obvious electoral implications of all of this debate we haven't talked about is for the 2008 presidential campaign. And there, I think you can see on the Republican side, a growing sense of unease that their support for the war, and all of them still support the war except for Ron Paul, who's clearly a second-tier candidate. And it seems to me inevitable that one of them is going to break fairly soon and come out against the Bush administration's war policy. And the most dramatic of those would be John McCain, because McCain has been to the right of the president on the war, saying we need even more troops there to get the job done. But McCain's campaign has been dead in the water now for several months, and there's recent financial reports showing that he's run out of money, he's had to lay off staff. One thing McCain could do to really shake things up would be to come out and say we need a change in policy in Iraq, and we need to rethink what we're doing with the troop surge. And that could reposition him in more of the maverick role that he's been known for in the past.
And he's in Iraq right now, isn't he?
That's right. I think he's supposed to get back either today or tomorrow. And so it's possible he could come back from Iraq and say, I've just been there, I've talked to the leaders, I've lost confidence in the government in Iraq. I don't think they're going to be able to meet the political benchmarks. I think it's time to start withdrawing troops.
Wow. Yeah.
And if he did that, it really would shake up things in the presidential race on the Republican side.
Yeah, but what about the criticism he was for the war before he was against it?
Well, that's right. And that's the problem that all supporters of the war face, including Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And so it is a real problem for the Republicans to be seen as flip-floppers. On the other hand, I think someone like McCain would have the credibility to do that because of his own war record and his own very strong position on this. And obviously, he wouldn't change something unless he was convinced that the situation has changed on the ground. Then that's one thing that Bush has been criticized for, is his unwillingness to be more flexible. And so McCain could show that he is willing to change his views once he's convinced that his policy was wrong. And just to say that, flat out, I was wrong on this, and I, things have changed, and we need to change our policy.
Yeah. Hillary Clinton, while she's saying that she wants to put an end to this war and bring the troops home, also is advocating keeping a presence there for a very long time.
Right, exactly. And that's why I think that a continued military presence in the region is probably going to happen regardless of a Democratic administration in 08 or 09 or Republican. I think that's part of the long-term plan for the area.
Yeah, John McCain shaking things up a bit aside, is who's best positioned in the presidential field right now based on the war in Iraq being the issue?
Well, I think Barack Obama clearly is the candidate who has the strongest position on Iraq right now, because he was against the war from the beginning. And of the major first-tier candidates, he's the only one who can make that claim. And so he doesn't have to worry about the flip-flop charge, and he's been a long-time opponent of the war. So I think Obama is clearly the one who is most favored by the war in Iraq right now and the increasing unpopularity of the war.
Let's take some more calls. Patrick in New Glarus is with us now. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air.
Thank you. Very quick question. I often hear members of the establishment media and even your guest use phrases like war on terror and troop surge as if they're neutral describers of reality rather than propaganda phrases concocted by the Bush White House as a means of describing a different kind of reality. And I'd like your guest to comment on that. I'll hang up now and listen.
I don't know if you used the term. I certainly did, but go ahead, Professor Cannon.
Yeah, I think I used the term troop surge certainly in talking about Bush's policy and how he was presenting it. So I think that is an accurate, when you're talking about the Bush administration's policy, I think it's accurate to use the term troop surge, because that's the term that they use. Now, I think the caller is right in terms of the war on terror. It is you know, it's not strictly a neutral term. It's so widely used that I think it's starting to become a more neutral term than perhaps it was at first. But the caller raises an interesting point. I mean, words do matter, mm-hmm. and the way that we present certain ideas really do matter by putting a normative spin on a concept. It does change the political dynamic of that debate, and so he's absolutely right that something like the war on terror, just by saying that, implies that this is a cause that we have to be pursuing, that we have to be fighting this war, that Americans should rally behind it. Whereas presenting it in a different way, a war on civil liberties or whatever, mm-hmm. if you wanted to spin it on the other side of the normative divide, the political divide, that would obviously have a very different spin on it. So I think it's an important point to make.
Thanks, Patrick. John in Highland is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. They keep changing the deal all the time. Now, you know, if we don't fight them in Afghanistan or in Iraq, we have to fight them here. Well, Afghanistan, if I'm not mistaken, is the place that started at. And we got a big deal. We got Hussein, and I just can't remember the name of that other son of a sweetheart that hit us at 9/11. He's still roaming around free. Why aren't we up there taking care of the first business first?
Yeah, well, this goes back to a point. Osama bin Laden is the name he's mm-hmm. searching for. This goes back to the point that was made earlier about the potential trade-off between the war on terror and the war in Iraq. If we would have focused our efforts on catching Osama bin Laden rather than shifting our attention to the war in Iraq, it's probably may have been able to be successful on that front. Instead, as John points out, we still haven't captured Osama bin Laden, and so that's yet more evidence for the trade-off between those two policies.
Thanks to John. Al in Milwaukee. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, just sitting here listening. I'm noting a news headline, USS Enterprise becomes third U.S. carrier deployed to Persian Gulf, which reminds me of a recent comment by Dennis Kucinich. We had a provision in a bill that we should not attack Iran. It was taken out. Dennis Kucinich and one other congressman said that when asked why it was taken out, they said because of the Israel lobby, which brings me up to the current story that is not being told, which is the tension Congress is in between the Israel lobby on the one hand, which everybody knows wields very great influence and which wants us to stay in Iraq, and the voice of the people on the other hand, who want us to get out. And what I'd like to see covered sometime is this battle for Congress that's being waged between the Israel lobby and the people. I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, can you tell us about that, Professor Cannon?
Well, boy, this is definitely a hot-button issue. And you know, clearly there are strong supporters for Israel in Congress. There's no doubt that's true. How much of that is, the consequence of lobbying? How much of that is a consequence of sincere preferences and desire to help Israel and maintain their security in that part of the world, is an open question. And the caller is also correct that certainly people who are strong supporters of Israel tend to be stronger supporters of the war in Iraq. I mean, it's not a one-to-one correspondence there, but that is a tendency. Having said that, I think that the balance in Congress is definitely tipping in the anti-war direction right now. With the start of the hour talking about the Republican defections on this and very strong Democratic support for the anti-war position. So while the supporters of Israel still have obviously a presence in Congress, it doesn't seem like that is overriding the Iraq position for very many people in Congress anyway.
I forgot to ask you, Professor Cannon, if you think that we, the people, the public, are blaming Democrats for not doing what we elected them to do, according to Cindy Sheehan, which is to end this war in Iraq. Are we mad at the Democrats because nothing's happened?
Well, there appears to be some evidence to support that mm-hmm. The congressional approval rate right now is starting to hit all-time lows, that mm-hmm. we're in the sort of mid-20s or so, or mid to high 20s in the percentage of people who say they approve of the job that Congress is doing. And that's down fairly substantially, 10-15% down from where it was at the beginning of this Congress in January. So I think people had relatively high hopes for what the Democrats might be able to achieve. And now that we still have not made progress in the war in Iraq, I think there are some people who've kind of turned against the Democrats in Congress. Now, on the other hand, my own personal view is that that's not entirely reasonable, given that they did try. Mm-hmm. The Democrats did stay in line. About 95% or so of the Democrats did vote in favor of troop withdrawal, but they didn't have the votes to override a presidential veto. And given the way our system is set up with the presidential veto, there's nothing the majority party can do if the president exercises a veto if they don't have those two-thirds vote. So I think it's a bit unfair to criticize the Democrats for not getting the troops out when they just simply didn't have enough Republican support to do that.
Tom in Fond du Lac is with us now. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'm just wondering what you would think of this scenario. Iraq has tremendous potential oil wealth, and there's got to be a lot of intelligent people over there. And they realize that we're going to be pulling out probably fairly soon. And I'm thinking there's got to be some people over there who are planning to take over. Maybe the military might wind up being kind of a mafia-type organization. And I'm wondering what you think of that scenario.
Well, yeah, there definitely will be an internal power struggle after we leave. There's obviously that's going to happen. In terms of who is going to come to power, and which factions will be able to assert control, remains to be seen. I mean, ideally you'd have some kind of, the best case scenario would be some kind of power sharing arrangement between the Kurds, Shiites, and Sunnis. I think that would be a very difficult goal to achieve, given that they don't seem to be able to move in that direction even when American troops are there. So absent that kind of power-sharing arrangement, the only other alternative is having one of those three factions emerge, and it would seem like the Shiites would be the most likely possibility, given that their sort of numerical superiority. But whether this would be military style, dictatorship, you used the word a mafia type system implying a lot of corruption. That would, again, be kind of a worst case scenario, but it is certainly possible.
Dave in Madison is with us. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I help you guys sum this up. I would have to say that in 2002, before we went to war, the Congress they looked at it. It was in the best interest of the United States of America to take out Saddam Hussein. They all voted. Right now, it's a political thing now to make commitment to the Iraqi people and to now pull out and leave that place in. It would be a total catastrophe. Everybody, if you ask any congressman, that if we pulled out now, the Iraq would fall apart. It would make the Middle East so unstable that it would hurt us in the future so bad that we would have to be back there for many years to come to mop it up. So people who are against this war, to pull out now, would just be a catastrophe.
We're going to give our guest a little bit. We only have a minute to go, Professor Cannon.
Yeah, well, the one point that he makes is actually a point we haven't talked about yet, which I think is an important one to raise, is that the flip side of the moral argument. A previous caller made an argument about the immorality of the war and how immoral it is that we've been there at all, so that's a reason for coming home. But the caller makes an important point here, though, which is there's also a moral argument to be made for staying. That is, it's our responsibility that we made this mess, and now just to leave them high and dry and to come home without trying to solve the problem, it's our responsibility, our moral responsibility to not do that, given that we created the mess. So, there definitely is a flip side on that moral argument as well.
And that'll be where we leave it for today. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
David Cannon, Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thanks to Karen Prager and to Leo Duran for producing this hour. Thank you for listening and calling in. Stay tuned. There's much more to come. And if you'd like a CD copy of this or any of our talk shows, you can call the radio store, 1-800-747-7444. You can also listen to our talk shows through your computer. They are all archived on our website, wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.